Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Nivel C2. Convocatoria, junio 2020. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1.
Speaker zero.
Reaching as many people as possible. I mean, obviously you want to reach as many people as possible, but we need to think about some of these new dangers and pitfalls of social media and the health concerns and the fact that it has been proven that a brain or a chemical is released in the brain, similar to a drug, when we get certain notifications or responses on Facebook. And so Facebook has, and Instagram and all these other social media platforms are essentially in many ways kind of a drug.
Yeah, no, it really is. You're waiting to see how many likes you get off it. Okay, today I got, like you said, 2 likes, 4 likes, 5 likes, 10 likes, 30 likes, 100 likes, whatever.
Speaker one.
Now, my final guest today, a guest I'm very much looking forward to speaking with, and that is because the question that he asks is a question which I ask myself frequently. And although he writes about this in his book, On the Other Side of the Pond, this is applicable to all of us who live with social media at our fingertips. The question is, have we all become selfie-snapping narcissists? And the author of the book, Social Side, How America is Loving Itself to Death, is written by Leo J. Battenhausen, and I'm delighted that I've got him on the line today. Good morning, Leo.
Good morning, Pippa.
And indeed, I say good morning.
Speaker two.
But now you're in charge at Instagram, right? So what is your lesson as a person who designs these things about like how a tool can be manipulated?
The most important lesson to me is that when you build a new feature or idea, we'll come up with something benign. Let's say events on Facebook didn't exist. And we're like, oh, we're going to build events. It'll be great. People will be able to schedule time and get together and hang out in the real world. That's awesome. That's exciting. We should be enthusiastic about that. But we need to also think about how events might be misused. Could spammers use it to try and get people to, I don't know, buy fake iPads? Or could people use it to try to get people that they want to meet in real life in nefarious ways? You have to approach it with like a an adversarial mindset.
Speaker 3.
Could you just remind people who, for those who did not hear our prior conversation, why you feel that abusive tweets, this kind of communication, rises to the level of a human rights concern, such that Amnesty would take as much time and effort as it has to investigate it? Why do you think this is a problem?
It's a problem because if women are disproportionately experiencing abuse or harassment or are targets of problematic tweets, then this means that this could have a silencing effect on them. And this is something that we found in our research, that women tend to change the way in which they interact on these platforms. They tend to, you know, withdraw from Twitter or change the way in which they use their language on Twitter in order to not subject themselves or open themselves up to abuse. And, you know, our research has shown that 7.1% of tweets that were sent to women.
Speaker 4.
For example, they're cancelled immediately and their whole life is shattered because of something that somebody captured online, which, I mean...
They deserve to be caught, though.
Well, of course. I was about to say, it's not a bad thing at all.
That's the reason I think social media is brilliant sometimes, because it catches people's innermost thoughts, because, you know, that's why I like Twitter most. Twitter's like a goldfish bowl. Yeah. Everybody's in your living room. And people reacting off what people are saying. So that means you catch someone's honest opinion at that minute, at that time. It's always best that, you know, people are corrected on their misconception, on their, you know, racist views, like the people can pull them up. Because otherwise, I just feel like people would just conceal it. And
Speaker 5.
Yeah. So, Catherine, what are the dangers as you see them?
Well, you know, we go from risk to danger and, you know, normal, again, it's a normal adolescent behaviour to take risks. But for a number of the children that I've actually worked with in therapy, one of the things that they have done is they've spoken about how they feel to their peers, and they might do that on social media platforms, gaming platforms, it might even be on forums. And what that does is it opens them up to a predication of, you know, the fact that predators can use this information to have a conversation with young people. That information can be almost used in a really quite tacit way by other peers, in terms of, you know, a young girl may say, I'm feeling really upset, I haven't really got much time to talk to my parents, I'm a carer at home. And then what happens is they may be teased, they may be cyberbullied, and again, that's a phenomenon in its own right. But it can be used by perpetrators to then say, hey, I'm here, I'm listening. And actually, in terms of when children are groomed, this is the entirety of the process. It's about being seen, soothed, safe and secure, which normally they're looking for from parents. And if you can't get it from your parents, you will go and seek it elsewhere.
So what do you say to those young people?
Speaker 6.
Behaviours online.
Many thanks. That's Phil Powell from Sheffield University.
So far, we've looked at how social media can affect us socially and politically, and also possibly impact on our well-being. Well, as we've discussed, more than 2 billion of us are using social media, or at least were in 2016. It's 20% more now. And Facebook has the highest number of active consumers. In fact, the average user spends nearly an hour on Facebook's suite of applications every day. But some people invest considerably more time than this and may even forego other pleasures in life to feed their habit. They may even complain that they feel physically unwell if they become separated from social media for any period of time. Might they therefore be considered addicted? Daria Koos is at Nottingham Trent University.
We have some research that has been conducted around the world which would suggest that social media use in some instances for...
Speaker 0.
Reaching as many people as possible. I mean, obviously you want to reach as many people as possible, but we need to think about some of these new dangers and pitfalls of social media and the health concerns and the fact that it has been proven that a brain or a chemical is released in the brain, similar to a drug, when we get certain notifications or responses on Facebook. And so Facebook has, and Instagram and all these other social media platforms are essentially, in many ways, kind of a drug.
Yeah, no, it really is. You're waiting to see how many likes you get off it. Okay, today I got, like you said, 2 likes, 4 likes, 5 likes, 10 likes, 30 likes, 100 likes, whatever.
Speaker 1.
Now, my final guest today, a guest I'm very much looking forward to speaking with, and that is because the question that he asks is a question which I ask myself frequently. And although he writes about this in his book, On the Other Side of the Pond, this is applicable to all of us who live with social media at our fingertips. The question is, have we all become selfie-snapping narcissists? And the author of the book, Social Side, How America is Loving Itself to Death, is written by Leo J. Battenhausen, and I'm delighted that I've got him on the line today. Good morning, Leo.
Good morning, Pippa.
And indeed, I say good morning.
Speaker 2.
But now you're in charge at Instagram, right? So what is your lesson as a person who designs these things about like how a tool can be manipulated?
The most important lesson to me is that when you build a new feature or idea, we'll come up with something benign. Let's say events on Facebook didn't exist. And we're like, oh, we're going to build events. It'll be great. People will be able to schedule time and get together and hang out in the real world. That's awesome. That's exciting. We should be enthusiastic about that. But we need to also think about how events might be misused. Could spammers use it to try and get people to, I don't know, buy fake iPads? Or could people use it to try to get people that they want to meet in real life in nefarious ways? You have to approach it with like an adversarial mindset.
Speaker 3.
Could you just remind people for those who did not hear our prior conversation, why you feel that abusive tweets, this kind of communication, rises to the level of a human rights concern, such that Amnesty would take as much time and effort as it has to investigate it? Why do you think this is a problem?
It's a problem because if women are disproportionately experiencing abuse or harassment or are targets of problematic tweets, then this means that this could have a silencing effect on them. And this is something that we found in our research, that women tend to change the way in which they interact on these platforms. They tend to, you know, withdraw from Twitter or change the way in which they use their language on Twitter in order to not subject themselves or open themselves up to abuse. And, you know, our research has shown that 7.1% of tweets that were sent to women.
Speaker 4.
For example, they're cancelled immediately and their whole life is shattered because of something that somebody captured online, which, I mean...
They deserve to be caught, though.
Well, of course.
It's not a bad thing at all. That's the reason I think social media is brilliant sometimes, because it catches people's innermost thoughts, because, you know, that's why I like Twitter most. Twitter's like a goldfish bowl. Yeah. Everybody's in your living room. And people reacting off what people are saying. So that means you catch someone's honest opinion at that minute, at that time. It's always best that, you know, people are corrected on their misconception, on their, you know, racist views. Like, the people can pull them up. Because otherwise, I just feel like people will just conceal it. And
Speaker 5.
Yeah. So, Catherine, what are the dangers as you see them?
Well, you know, we go from risk to danger and, you know, normal, again, it's a normal adolescent behaviour to take risks. But for a number of the children that I've actually worked with in therapy, one of the things that they have done is they've spoken about how they feel to their peers, and they might do that on social media platforms, gaming platforms, it might even be on forums. And what that does is it opens them up to a predication of, you know, the fact that predators can use this information to have a conversation with young people. That information can be almost used in a really quite tacit way by other peers. In terms of, you know, a young girl may say, I'm feeling really upset, I haven't really got much time to talk to my parents, I'm a carer at home. And then what happens is they may be teased, they may be cyberbullied, and again, that's a phenomenon in its own right. But it can be used by perpetrators to then say, hey, I'm here, I'm listening. And actually, in terms of when children are groomed, this is the entirety of the process. It's about being seen, soothed, safe and secure, which normally they're looking for from parents. And if you can't get it from your parents, you will go and seek it elsewhere.
So what do you say to those young people?
Speaker 6.
Behaviours online.
Many thanks. That's Phil Powell from Sheffield University.
So far, we've looked at how social media can affect us socially and politically, and also possibly impact on our well-being. Well, as we've discussed, more than 2 billion of us are using social media, or at least were in 2016. It's 20% more now. And Facebook has the highest number of active consumers. In fact, the average user spends nearly an hour on Facebook's suite of applications every day. But some people invest considerably more time than this and may even forego other pleasures in life to feed their habit. They may even complain that they feel physically unwell if they become separated from social media for any period of time. Might they therefore be considered addicted? Daria Kous is at Nottingham Trent University.
We have some research that has been conducted around the world which would suggest that social media use in some instances for...
Task 2. I'm Emma Freud. In real life, I'm a writer and broadcaster. In my dreams, I'm an investigative journalist exposing social injustice in dangerous international territories while wearing an attractive camouflage jumpsuit. Rukmini Kalimaki is the person I wish I was. In real life, she's the ISIS correspondent for The New York Times, a four-time Pulitzer Prize finalist and host of the award-winning podcast Caliphate, which charts a major interview with a former ISIS soldier. Just to set the scene, Rukmini, so that people know who you are, how many times have you interviewed members of ISIS?
Several dozen times, over 50.
How many death threats have been made against you by terrorist groups?
I've lost track of how many, but I can tell you that on six different occasions, the FBI considered the threats against me to be serious enough that they themselves called to warn me of them.
Why do you do what you do?
I think that what I'm doing is making a difference. I feel that the work is important. And in the end, the war on terror has now cost over $1 trillion. It's not just in terms of cash, but also in terms of blood that has been spilled. And yet this group, in my opinion, remains very misunderstood. And I feel that that is where my work comes in, where I'm trying to understand them in a more meaningful way.
In order to be able to defeat the ideology, to understand in order to arm ourselves, is that why?
That's an accurate way to put it. I mean, it's the ultimate adage. How do you defeat your enemy if you don't know your enemy?
The thing that I took away from Caliphate was the journey that boy had gone on that up until I listened to you talking to him was incomprehensible to me. How a Canadian 23-year-old, whatever he was, could lash other people with whips 100 times, could kill because somebody had smoked weed. I can't remember what the offense was, but he was worthy of death according to the ISIS law. And but by the end of those 11 hours, I understood it. I got it.
Right. That's exactly how we felt. We meaning myself and Andy Mills, who was the producer of Caliphate. That's exactly how we felt after having spent hours speaking to Huzaifa during this incredible interview. But as soon as you step away from it and you start trying to explain that to colleagues or to friends, it starts to fall apart because once again, you're explaining this monstrosity. You're explaining that the most grotesque thing in the world, which is taking another human life and taking it in a way that is meant to exact enormous pain.
And yet, in order, as you said earlier, to understand them, you need to talk to them. And in order to talk to them and to actually get somewhere, you need to come at them with a certain degree of compassion.
I've taken a lot of heat for this. You know, there's not a lot of people who think that being empathetic towards ISIS is a good idea. In fact, when we were editing Caliphate, this was one of our central concerns, is this empathy that I'm showing for this person who is an avowed murderer, is that going to be misinterpreted as giving ISIS a platform or allowing ISIS to justify themselves? And I'm always struggling with this internally because, of course, I don't ever want my work to be that. I came to the States when I was 10 years old as an immigrant. I was born in Romania in the communist period. My parents fled the Ceausescu regime. We were, for a short amount of time, political refugees in Switzerland. So my own story is a story of being an outsider, a story of going from a place that I felt very comfortable and loved in to constantly being a curiosity or something different. And that, I think, has somehow conditioned me to perhaps be a tad less judgmental of people who are very different than ourselves.
I think one of the reasons that you're so effective in getting information from people who you would never expect. I'm Emma Freud. In real life, I'm a writer and broadcaster. In my dreams, I'm an investigative journalist exposing social injustice in dangerous international territories while wearing an attractive camouflage jumpsuit. Rukmini Kalimaki is the person I wish I was. In real life, she's the ISIS correspondent for The New York Times, a four-time Pulitzer Prize finalist and host of the award-winning podcast Caliphate, which charts a major interview with a former ISIS soldier. Just to set the scene, Rukmini, so that people know who you are, how many times have you interviewed members of ISIS?
Several dozen times, over 50.
How many death threats have been made against you by terrorist groups?
I've lost track of how many, but I can tell you that on six different occasions, the FBI considered the threats against me to be serious enough that they themselves called to warn me of them.
Why do you do what you do?
I think that what I'm doing is making a difference. I feel that the work is important. And in the end, the war on terror has now cost over $1 trillion. It's not just in terms of cash, but also in terms of blood that has been spilled. And yet this group, in my opinion, remains very misunderstood. And I feel that that is where my work comes in, where I'm trying to understand them in a more meaningful way.
In order to be able to defeat the ideology, to understand in order to arm ourselves, is that why?
That's an accurate way to put it. I mean, it's the ultimate adage. How do you defeat your enemy if you don't know your enemy?
The thing that I took away from Caliphate was the journey that boy had gone on that up until I listened to you talking to him was incomprehensible to me. How a Canadian 23-year-old, whatever he was, could lash other people with whips 100 times, could kill because somebody had smoked weed. I can't remember what the offense was, but he was worthy of death according to the ISIS law. And but by the end of those 11 hours, I understood it. I got it.
Right. That's exactly how we felt. We meaning myself and Andy Mills, who was the producer of Caliphate. That's exactly how we felt after having spent hours speaking to Huzaifa during this incredible interview. But as soon as you step away from it and you start trying to explain that to colleagues or to friends, it starts to fall apart because once again, you're explaining this monstrosity. You're explaining the most grotesque thing in the world, which is taking another human life and taking it in a way that is meant to exact enormous pain.
And yet, in order, as you said earlier, to understand them, you need to talk to them. And in order to talk to them and to actually get somewhere, you need to come at them with a certain degree of compassion.
I've taken a lot of heat for this. You know, there's not a lot of people who think that being empathetic towards ISIS is a good idea. In fact, when we were editing Caliphate, this was one of our central concerns, is this empathy that I'm showing for this person who is an avowed murderer, is that going to be misinterpreted as giving ISIS a platform or allowing ISIS to justify themselves? And I'm always struggling with this internally because, of course, I don't ever want my work to be that. I came to the States when I was 10 years old as an immigrant. I was born in Romania in the communist period. My parents fled the Ceausescu regime. We were for a short amount of time political refugees in Switzerland. So my own story is a story of being an outsider, a story of going from a place that I felt very comfortable and loved in to constantly being a curiosity or something different. And that, I think, has somehow conditioned me to perhaps be a tad less judgmental of people who are very different than ourselves.
I think one of the reasons that you're so effective in getting information from people who you would never expect.
Task 3.
The devil has come to town. But don't worry, all he wants to do is stage a magic show. This absurd premise forms the central plot of Mikhail Bulgakov's masterpiece, The Master and Margarita. Written in Moscow during the 1930s, this surreal blend of political satire, historical fiction, and occult mysticism has earned a legacy as one of the 20th century's greatest novels, and one of its strangest. The story begins when a meeting between two members of Moscow's literary elite is interrupted by a strange gentleman named Woland, who presents himself as a foreign scholar invited to give a presentation on black magic. As the stranger engages the two companions in a philosophical debate and makes ominous predictions about their fates, the reader is suddenly transported to first century Jerusalem. There, a tormented Pontius Pilate reluctantly sentences Jesus of Nazareth to death. With the narrative shifting between the two settings, Woland and his entourage, Azazela, Kroviev, Gela, and a giant cat named Behemoth, are seen to have uncanny magical powers, which they use to stage their performance while leaving a trail of havoc and confusion in their wake. Much of the novel's dark humor comes not only from this demonic mischief, but also the backdrop against which it occurs. Bulgakov's story takes place in the same setting where it was written, the USSR, at the height of the Stalinist period. There, artists and authors worked under strict censorship, subject to imprisonment, exile, or execution if they were seen as undermining state ideology. Even when approved, their work, along with housing, travel, and everything else, was governed by a convoluted bureaucracy. In the novel, Woland manipulates this system along with the fabric of reality to hilarious results. As heads are separated from bodies and money rains from the sky, the citizens of Moscow react with petty self-interest, illustrating how Soviet society bred greed and cynicism despite its ideals. And the matter-of-fact narration deliberately blends the strangeness of the supernatural events with the everyday absurdity of Soviet life. So how did Bulgakov manage to publish such a subversive novel under an oppressive regime? Well, he didn't. He worked on The Master and Margarita for over 10 years, but while Stalin's personal favor may have kept Bulgakov safe from severe persecution, many of his plays and writings were kept from production, leaving him safe but effectively silenced. Upon the author's death in 1940, the manuscript remained unpublished. A censored version was eventually printed in the 1960s, while copies of the unabridged manuscript continued to circulate among underground literary circles. The full text was only published in 1973, over 30 years after its completion. Bulgakov's experiences with censorship and artistic frustration lend an autobiographical air to the second part of the novel, when we are finally introduced to its namesake. The Master is a nameless author who's worked for years on a novel but burned the manuscript after it was rejected by publishers, just as Bulgakov had done with his own work. Yet the true protagonist is the Master's mistress, Margarita. Her devotion to her lover's abandoned dream bears a strange connection to the diabolical company's escapades and carries the story to its surreal climax. Despite its dark humor and complex structure, The Master and Margarita is, at its heart, a meditation on art, love, and redemption that never loses itself in cynicism. And the book's long overdue publication and survival against the odds is a testament to what Wolin tells the Master. Manuscripts don't burn. The devil has come to town. But don't worry, all he wants to do is stage a magic show. This absurd premise forms the central plot of Mikhail Bulgakov's masterpiece, The Master and Margarita. Written in Moscow during the 1930s, this surreal blend of political satire, historical fiction, and occult mysticism has earned a legacy as one of the 20th century's greatest novels and one of its strangest. The story begins when a meeting between two members of Moscow's literary elite is interrupted by a strange gentleman named Woland, who presents himself as a foreign scholar invited to give a presentation on black magic. As the stranger engages the two companions in a philosophical debate and makes ominous predictions about their fates, the reader is suddenly transported to first century Jerusalem. There, a tormented Pontius Pilate reluctantly sentences Jesus of Nazareth to death. With the narrative shifting between the two settings, Woland and his entourage, Azazela, Kroviev, Gela, and a giant cat named Behemoth, are seen to have uncanny magical powers, which they use to stage their performance while leaving a trail of havoc and confusion in their wake. Much of the novel's dark humor comes not only from this demonic mischief, but also the backdrop against which it occurs. Bulgakov's story takes place in the same setting where it was written, the USSR, at the height of the Stalinist period. There, artists and authors worked under strict censorship, subject to imprisonment, exile, or execution if they were seen as undermining state ideology. Even when approved, their work, along with housing, travel, and everything else, was governed by a convoluted bureaucracy. In the novel, Woland manipulates this system, along with the fabric of reality, to hilarious results. As heads are separated from bodies and money rains from the sky, the citizens of Moscow react with petty self-interest, illustrating how Soviet society bred greed and cynicism despite its ideals. And the matter-of-fact narration deliberately blends the strangeness of the supernatural events with the everyday absurdity of Soviet life. So how did Bulgakov manage to publish such a subversive novel under an oppressive regime? Well, he didn't. He worked on The Master and Margarita for over 10 years, but while Stalin's personal favor may have kept Bulgakov safe from severe persecution, many of his plays and writings were kept from production, leaving him safe but effectively silenced. Upon the author's death in 1940, the manuscript remained unpublished. A censored version was eventually printed in the 1960s, while copies of the unabridged manuscript continued to circulate among underground literary circles. The full text was only published in 1973, over 30 years after its completion. Bulgakov's experiences with censorship and artistic frustration lend an autobiographical air to the second part of the novel, when we are finally introduced to its namesake. The Master is a nameless author who's worked for years on a novel but burned the manuscript after it was rejected by publishers, just as Bulgakov had done with his own work. Yet the true protagonist is the Master's mistress, Margarita. Her devotion to her lover's abandoned dream bears a strange connection to the diabolical company's escapades and carries the story to its surreal climax. Despite its dark humor and complex structure, The Master and Margarita is, at its heart, a meditation on art, love, and redemption that never loses itself in cynicism. And the book's long overdue publication and survival against the odds is a testament to what Woland tells the Master. Manuscripts don't burn.
Fin de la prueba.